So what's the result? Very few individuals get patents, for obvious reasons. Companies, on the other hand, get a ton of them. They are useful as weapons against other companies that threaten to sue over the patents they own. The patent system of today is basically a Cold War, with IP instead of nukes. And it's not much prettier. The people left huddling in bomb shelters are the individual inventors, who have to deal with a system gone crazy and who lack the resources to have 12,000 lawyers on staff. Now, if you want to avoid the bother with patents, you can go for the strongest drugs of IP, trade secrets. The advantage of the trade secret is that you don't have to worry about a trade secret office or anything at all. You can just stamp your intellectual property, quote, secret, and be done with it. You can still tell people about it, but you have to tell them it's a secret. People used to do this all the time before, and that is actually why patent law was originally introduced. In order to encourage individuals and companies to expose their secrets, patent law allowed for protection in the marketplace for some time, if you divulged what your secret to success was. A basic form of tit for tat. You tell how you do something, and we'll give you exclusive rights for X years. Before patents, people would guard their technological advantage jealously and take their secrets to the grave. That was, for obvious reasons, bad for technical evolution because promising technologies were never divulged to anybody else. The promise of exclusive rights made patents a very powerful incentive to tell all. You no longer had to worry about your competition finding out what you were doing, at which point you would otherwise have lost the protection of it being secret. However, that was then, and this is now. These days, even trade secrets have legal protection, for unfathomable reasons. Any sane person realizes that once a secret is out, it is no longer a secret, except in the strange and twisty passages of intellectual property law, where secrets can continue to be secrets even after everybody knows what they are, and where the knowledge you have in your head can get you sued if you happen to go to work for the wrong employer. Some intellectual property law is downright scary. To a large degree, finding peace in this intellectual property war is what open source is all about. While a lot of people have their own opinions about what open source really tries to do, in many ways you can see it as a high-tech detente, a defusing of copyright as a weapon in this fight of intellectual property. So open source would rather use the legal weapon of copyright as an invitation to join in the fun, rather than as a weapon against others. It's still the same old mantra, make love, not war, except on a slightly more abstract level, probably a lot more abstract, considering some of the geeks Linus knows. But as with any major philosophical rift, there is always the other side of the story. This is where Linus's certifiable schizophrenia comes in. He's tried to explain why a lot of people feel that intellectual property, and especially the strengthening of intellectual property laws, is downright evil. Many in the open source community, and outside too, in all honesty, would like nothing better than to tear down all the nukes altogether and totally abolish the Cold War of knowledge. Others disagree. The other side of the picture is that, yes, intellectual property may be unfair, and yes, intellectual property laws are largely designed to further the aims of large corporations over the rights of consumers or even the individual author or inventor. But boy, is it lucrative! It concentrates the power of the powerful, and the very fact that it's a powerful weapon makes it so effective in the marketplace. The same reason that made nuclear weapons the ultimate force in the Cold War makes intellectual property so attractive in the war of technology. And technology sells. And it also generates a very powerful, positive feedback cycle. Because intellectual property is such a good source of revenue, a lot of money is being spent on creating more intellectual property. And that very fact is important. In the same ways that wars have historically always been a source of invention and great leaps in engineering, initially, the computer itself was largely developed for purely military purposes. The virtual war of intellectual property rights helps feed the engine and brings never-before-seen resources into technology development. This is a good thing. Of course, Linus, as a self-styled intellectual snob, is convinced that merely throwing resources around is not really all that conducive to true creativity. Just look at the music business of today. Kajillions of dollars are spent every year in finding the next hot artist. Yet nobody really thinks that the Spice Girls, who have been richly rewarded for their contributions to art, can compare to Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, who died destitute. So throwing money at the problem does not make for that kind of genius. But intellectual snobism, the "you can't buy a genius" philosophy, doesn't really work as a long-term business model. The creative juices are just so unpredictable, so hard to court on finding, that any long-term planning should not concentrate on the promise of pure genius. The technology development of today, and sadly, the music, depends not on the Einsteins and Mozarts, but on a huge army of plotting engineers, and, in the case of music, well-endowed young females who may show only occasional flashes of brilliance. The added resources do not make for great art, but for slow and steady progress. And, in the end, this is all to the best. The notion of plotting engineers may have less romantic appeal than the eccentric genius approach. Just think about how many mad scientist movies there are compared to the number of plotting engineer movies. However, when it comes down to business, you do want your occasional flashes of genius, but even more than that, you want the steady stream of small improvements over time. And this is where the power of intellectual property shines. Having grown so lucrative, it has become the holy grail of modern technology companies, feeding this big machine. And thus, thanks to IP protections, the steady progress goes on unhindered. It may not be all that creative anymore, but it's dependable. So Linus sees both sides, although he admits that most of the time he'd rather see a more fun and inspiring world of technology, one where economic factors wouldn't always prevail. He has a dream. One day, IP laws will be dictated by morals, not on who gets the biggest piece of the cake. Linus understands the economic issues. At the same time, he can't help but wish they did not have such an overwhelmingly negative impact on modern intellectual property law. The economic incentives to strengthen the ownership of intellectual property and the difficulty in expressing the notion of fair use and morals in legal text have caused the two viewpoints on IP to grow farther apart. As in a dispute between two neighbors, neither side is willing to even acknowledge that the right solution is likely to be somewhere in between the two extremes. Imagine an intellectual property law that actually took other people's rights into account, too. Imagine IP laws that encouraged openness and sharing. Laws that say, sure, you can still have your secrets, whether they be technological or religious, but that doesn't mandate legal protection for such secrecy. Yeah, I know. How unrealistic. The way to survive and flourish is to make the best damn product you can. And if you can't survive and flourish on that, then you shouldn't. If you can't make a good car, then you deserve to go down, like the rock that was the U.S. auto industry in the 1970s. Success is about quality and about giving folks what they want. It's not about trying to control people. The trouble is, people and companies are too often motivated by pure greed, and that always causes them to lose in the long run. Greed leads to decisions governed by paranoia and a need for total control. Those are bad, short-sighted decisions that end up in disaster, or near disaster. The simple example on everyone's mind has been the phenomenal early success of wireless technology in Europe at the expense of American companies. While the U.S. companies individually tried to control the market by using their own proprietary standards, the European companies rallied around a single standard, GSM, and chose to compete based on which company could produce the best product and provide the best service. The U.S. companies have fallen behind, plagued by their own competing standards. With a market buoyed by a common standard, the European companies have all shared in the boom. That's why kids in Prague were swapping cell phone text messages years before kids in Peoria had even heard about it as a new way of cheating on tests. If you try to make money by controlling a resource, you'll eventually find yourself out of business. This is a form of despotism, and history overflows with examples of its ill effects. Say it's the 1800s in the U.S. West, and you control the source for water for local farmers. You're stingy with the water and overcharge. At some point, it inevitably becomes profitable for someone else to devise a way to bring it in from somewhere else, and then your market collapses. Or technology advances so that pipes can transport water from a distance. Either way, as circumstances change, your hold gets broken, and you're left with nothing. This happens all the time, and it's amazing that people still can't see it coming. Flash forward to the music industry in the waning years of the 20th century. The resource it controls is entertainment. A company owns the rights to an artist's work. That artist produces a number of successful singles, but the company puts maybe one or two of those singles on each CD it produces. That way it can sell multiple CDs instead of the one that everyone wants. Then somebody invents the technology for MP3. Suddenly, music can be downloaded from the internet. MP3 is about doing the right thing for consumers by giving them a choice. So if a typical CD costs $10 and contains two singles a consumer wants, it may make more sense for him to purchase those singles separately, along with others he wants, off MP3 for $1.50 apiece. No longer is the buyer trapped in a despotic situation, living by the greed-inspired rules of the music company, which wants to give up just the bite-sized pieces that it chooses to give up. There's a good reason why the music industry is scared to death of MP3 and its sister technologies, Napster and Nutella. The price of water got so high that it became profitable for somebody to devise a new method of bringing it in from somewhere else. But this is an industry with a history of trying to control consumers, if not by what music it chooses to release, then by copyright and technology. This is the industry that tripped all over itself in the 1960s, trying to keep consumers from copying music onto tapes, when that technology entered the market. Because the industry felt tapes were the perfect medium for people to disobey copyright laws, it argued for ways to protect its copyrights. This was a bad excuse. The industry was taking the moral high ground and pleading copyright when it was simply trying to maintain control of its niche franchise. The fact is, tapes never hurt the music industry. Sure, people copied music for their own use, but that only meant that people actually bought more LPs from which to copy. Duh. A few decades later, when CDs came out, the players were built so that you couldn't copy your tape perfectly. Paranoia strikes again. Next came digital tapes. They involved a different sampling rate from the CDs, 48 kHz versus 44.1, to prevent users from copying their CDs onto digital tape. Again, the industry tried to screw over the customer to get control. But in the case of digital tapes, the market never quite hit. It was a bit like fooling with Mother Nature. By trying to control each successive technology, the music industry only helps inspire people to devise new ways around it. Are they ever going to get it? That brings us, inevitably, to DVDs. This time, the entertainment industry delivered much better sound and video than VHS tapes, plus a smaller format and greater ease of use. But they added encryption to prevent copying. And to add insult to injury, they added geographic area codes. the DVD you bought at the San Francisco airport wouldn't play in Europe. It made a perverse sense to the industry. Hey, you guys, we can sell movies at a higher price in Europe. So let's make sure that Europeans can't buy movies from the United States. Could the entertainment industry not have predicted the obvious? That the price of water would get so high that somebody would devise a new method of piping it in from somewhere else? Yes, while the industry was greedily trying to control people through technology, the DVD encryption was cracked. Not even by people who wanted to copy DVDs, but by people who simply wanted to view them under Linux. These are folks who actually wanted to buy DVDs, but they couldn't. The discs would have been useless on their equipment. The industry's moves to protect its fiefdom backfired. It simply prevented the market from expanding and created the incentives for the cracking of the DVD encryption. Once again, the short-term strategy turned out to be the wrong thing to do. The entertainment industry is just one example. The same thing has been happening for years in software. That's why Microsoft's strategy of bundling software is ultimately doomed to fail. Open source products, on the other hand, cannot possibly be used in a despotic manner because they're free. If somebody tried to bundle things with Linux, somebody else could just unbundle it and sell it the way people really want it. It's doubly futile to attempt to control people through technology. In the end, it always not only hurts the company, but also hinders the acceptance of the technology. A recent example is Java, which has lost a lot of the appeal it originally had. By trying to control the Java environment, Sun Microsystems basically lost it. Java is still doing reasonably well, but it surely hasn't lived up to its potential. Sun wasn't trying to make money on Java itself, but the company saw the programming language as a way to make its computers more unique to users and get us out of Microsoft's grip and sell more Sun hardware, by the way. But while they weren't really trying to make money on Java, they did feel that they had to keep control of it as a phenomenon and as a microbe. All of their licensing terms came with a lot of extra baggage just for this control. Good product, but the problem was that they were trying too hard to screw over Microsoft. They were motivated by fear, loathing, and hate, which is sort of a mid to late 1990s approach to business. Think of the Grateful Dead lyric, "Ain't no time to hate." And because they were so hateful of Microsoft and so afraid, they made all the wrong licensing decisions. They made it difficult for everybody, even their partners, to use the product. That's why companies like Hewlett-Packard and IBM all eventually decided to make their own Java implementations. They just said, "Screw Sun." Sun tried to get Java standardized through two different standardization bodies, and each time they basically pulled out because of the control issues. On the one hand, Sun wanted to standardize the language, but at the same time, they didn't want to lose control. So the standardization boards basically said, "Hey, this is not just about you." And as a result, Sun just flaked out. It's an example of a company trying to control technology in ways that make no sense for the people who actually use the technology. And it's always going to fail for the company. It also makes the technology itself fail, or take longer to be accepted. Contrast that with the "if you love something, set it free" strategy taken by Palm Computing. The folks at Palm made their development environment open and also opened up their platform, not only to vendors but to individuals who would want to write programs for the platform. They opened up their APIs and made it easy to get development tools for free. What this did was create a cottage industry around the Palm Pilot. It made the Palm phenomenon more than just one company struggling in a new market. So now you have companies selling games that work on Palm Pilots and more advanced calendar programs than what Palm itself offers. Now the consumer can choose what he or she wants, and everybody benefits, particularly Palm, which enjoys a larger market as a result of opening itself up. Handspring is doing the same thing with its device, the Visor. It's a Palm competitor that uses the Palm operating system, and the company takes openness a step further by allowing hardware plugins, like GPS receivers and mobile phone attachments. Like Palm, Handspring is creating a community of companies to support a new platform. What Sun could have done is allow anybody to do their own Java, no strings attached, while wagering that they themselves could do a better job. That's the sign of a company that isn't blinded by greed or by the fear of competition. It's the sign of a company that believes in itself and doesn't have time to hate. Linus is on record saying that he's not been a very good predictor of much of anything in his life, as far as he can remember. Did he predict that the little operating system he started writing for his own use would someday be all over the place? Nope. Took him by surprise, it did. His only defense is that nobody else seems to be doing any better on this crystal ball thing either. And if he was taken by surprise by how big Linux became in the industry, then everybody else was absolutely flabbergasted. So he probably did better than most, and who knows? Maybe he will be known as the Nostradamus of our time. And maybe not. Here are some of his predictions for the future, anyway. We can, of course, look to past experience, Linus rightly believes. We can trace in sad detail how, say, an invincible-seeming company like AT&T went limp. And we can predict that if we stick around long enough, the weeds will overrun those tidy little green buildings in Redmond, too, someday. Just as today's hot young starlet will develop wrinkles, today's business hero will be supplanted by a new, more inspired model. And the hero's company, even if it breaks a sweat reinventing itself, or whatever they're calling it this month, will end up sagging and groaning, AT&T style. Call it evolution. It's certainly not rocket science. No business will live forever. And that is just as well. But what is it that actually drives this evolution? Is there some fundamental, inherent evolution of technology that will one day cause computers to take over, leaving the human race behind in the dust, like some people seem to think? Or is it just some random inevitability of progress, a straight-ahead-and-damn-the-torpedoes kind of thing that causes technological advances? Linus says no. He says technology is what we make of it, and neither business nor technology will change the basic nature of human needs and yearnings. As with everything else, the evolution slowly but inexorably will cause technology to move away from plain survival through a society based on communication and finally into the realm of entertainment. Humans are destined to be party animals, and technology will follow. So forget all the predictions about what technology can do in 10 years. That's not very relevant at all. We were able to put a man on the moon 30 years ago, and we've not been back since. Linus is personally convinced that it is simply because the moon turned out to be a drab place with basically no nightlife at all. As a result, people didn't want to go back, and the amount of technology we've amassed in the meantime doesn't mean a thing. The moon stays empty. What really matters when you talk about the future of technology is what people want. Once you've figured that out, the only remaining question is how quickly you can mass-produce the thing and make it cheap enough that people can get it without sacrificing anything else they want. Nothing else really matters. A small digression is in order here. What really sells, of course, is perception, not reality. Cruise liners sell the perception of freedom, of the salty seas, of good food, and romance of love boat proportions. Who cares if the cabin is cramped if you feel like you're free as a bird? And what does this all mean? It explains, for example, why people are going so gaga over the Sony PlayStation 2, the single biggest piece of technology to hit the store shelves last year. Talk about the embodiment of the entertainment society. It also points out how personal computers have a perception problem. Clearly, the PC industry is nervous about game consoles, mainly because they are seen as non-threatening, fun, and cheap, while PCs are mostly seen as complicated and expensive. It also makes Linus personally convinced that if we're still talking in a big way about operating systems 15 years from now, something is seriously wrong somewhere. This may sound strange coming from somebody whose main claim to fame is writing his own operating system, but the fact is that, statistically speaking, nobody wants an operating system. In fact, nobody even wants a computer. What everybody wants is this magical toy that can be used to browse the web, write term papers, play games, balance the checkbook, and so on. The fact that you need a computer and an operating system to do all this is something that most people would rather not ever think about. This is why a lot of analysts like the notion of devices like the Sony PlayStation 2 that take over a number of the chores of a computer without having that scary, hand-sweat-producing property of being obviously complicated, scary machines, which is technologically senseless as we're getting more and more computers into the house all the time like this, while being unaware of how complicated and scary they could be. So Linus's bet for the next Microsoft would be Sony, if they can just get all the pieces lined up properly. Not that he's predicting the demise of the PC, like many have unsuccessfully done before. The fundamental strengths of PCs are still there. They are the Swiss army knife of computers. Overtly complicated enough to scare off people who don't like technology, and complicated exactly because they are not tailor-made for only one thing. That flexibility becomes the very thing that makes them attractive. And then, the one ring to rule them all, and in the darkness bind them, communication, everywhere. You can't live without checking email at least twice an hour? No problem, my email-addicted friend. You can have the slightly guilty feeling of taking the day off at the beach, yet always be in touch with what's going on at work. Remember, what sells is not the reality of being on vacation, but the perception of freedom. Size does matter, after all, if only to make all of the technological wonders seem trivial and non-threatening. And where is Linux itself, and open source generally, in all of this? You won't even know. It will be inside those Sony machines. You'll never see it, you'll never know it, but it's there, making it all run. It will be in that cell phone, which is at the same time acting as your very own personal communications hub for the rest of your electronic widgets when you're away from your wireless local area network. You'll see, it's only a matter of time and money. IBM is a company with a history of screwing people over. It made its money by getting a captive audience and making sure nobody else got a foothold. That's how most computer companies worked, in fact. It's how some of them still do. Then, when IBM developed the personal computer, it unintentionally opened up its technology for anyone to replicate. That single act did more than anything to spur the PC revolution, which has in turn spurred the information revolution, internet revolution, new economy, whatever it is they're now calling the massive changes taking place throughout the world. It's the best illustration of the limitless benefits to be derived from the open source philosophy. While the PC wasn't developed using the open source model, it is an example of a technology that was open for any person or company to clone and improve and sell. In its purest form, the open source model allows anyone to participate in a project's development or commercial exploitation. Linux is obviously the most successful example. What started out in Linus's messy Helsinki bedroom has grown to become the largest collaborative project in the history of the world. It began as an ideology shared by software developers who believed that computer source code should be shared freely, with a general public license, the anti-copyright, as the movement's powerful tool. It evolved to become a method for the continuous development of the best technology. And it evolved further to gain widespread market acceptance, as seen in the snowballing adoption of Linux as an operating system for web servers, and in its unexpectedly generous IPOs. What was inspired by ideology has proved itself as technology and is working in the marketplace. Now open source is expanding beyond the technical and business domains. At Harvard University Law School, professors Larry Lessig, who is now at Stanford, and Charles Nesson have brought the open source model to law. They started the Open Law Project, which relies on volunteer lawyers and law students posting opinions and research to the project's website to help develop arguments and briefs challenging the United States Copyright Extension Act. The theory is that the strongest arguments will be developed when the largest number of legal minds are working on a project and as a mountain of information is generated through postings and repostings. The site nicely sums up the trade-off from the traditional approach. What we lose in secrecy, we expect to regain in depth of sources and breadth of argument. Put in another context, with a million eyes, all software bugs will vanish. It's a wrinkle on how academic research has been conducted for years, but one that makes sense on a number of fronts. Think how this approach could speed up the development of cures for disease, for example. Or how, with the best minds on the task, international diplomacy could be strengthened. As the world becomes smaller, as the pace of life and business intensifies, and as the technology and information become available, people realize the tight-fisted approach is becoming increasingly outmoded. The theory behind open source is simple. In the case of an operating system, the source code, the programming instructions underlying the system, is free. Anyone can improve it, change it, exploit it. But those improvements, changes, and exploitations have to be made freely available. Think Zen. The project belongs to no one and to everyone. When a project is opened up, there is rapid and continual improvement. With teams of contributors working in parallel, the results can happen far more speedily and successfully than if the work were being conducted behind closed doors. That's what was experienced with Linux. Imagine, instead of a tiny cloistered development team working in secret, you have a monster on your side. Potentially millions of the brightest minds are contributing to a project and are supported by a peer review process that has no, peer. The first time people hear about the open source approach, it sounds ludicrous. That's why it has taken years for the message of its virtues to sink in. Ideology isn't what has sold the open source model. It started getting attention when it was obvious that open source was the best method of developing and improving the highest quality technology. And now it is winning in the marketplace, an accomplishment that has brought open source its greatest acceptance. When the money rolls in, people get convinced. One of the least understood pieces of the open source puzzle is how so many good programmers would deign to work for absolutely no money. A word about motivation is in order. In a society where survival is more or less assured, money is not the greatest of motivators. It's been well established that folks do their best work when they are driven by a passion, when they are having fun. This is as true for playwrights and sculptors and entrepreneurs as it is for software engineers. The open source model gives people the opportunity to live their passion, to have fun, and to work with the world's best programmers, not the few who happen to be employed by their company. Open source developers strive to earn the esteem of their peers. That's got to be highly motivating. It seems that Bill Gates doesn't understand this. Is it possible that he's now embarrassed by an off-putting, rhetorical question he asked in 1976? One thing you do is prevent good software from being written. Who can afford to do professional work for nothing? He wrote in a letter to open source programmers. In fact, one way to understand the open source phenomenon is to think about how science was perceived by religion so many centuries ago, if not today by some creatures. Science was originally viewed as something dangerous, subversive, and anti-establishment, basically how software companies sometimes view open source. And just as science wasn't born out of an effort to undermine the religious establishment, open source wasn't conceived in order to detonate the software establishment. It is there to produce the best technology and to see where it goes. Science on its own does not make money. It has been the secondary effects of science that create all the wealth. The same goes for open source. It allows the creation of secondary industries that challenge established businesses, much the way the spin-offs of science challenged the church. You find small companies like VA Linux taking advantage of open source and suddenly being able to compete with traditional corporations. In the words of Sir Isaac Newton, standing on the shoulders of giants. Like science itself, open source's secondary effects are endless. It is creating things that until recently were considered impossible and opening up unexpected new markets. With Linux, as with other open source projects, companies can make their own versions and their own changes, which really isn't possible any other way. It's exciting to realize that just about everything that's ever been done with Linux was not remotely on the radar when it started. It is even taking off in China. Traditionally, software development in Asia has primarily been about translating American or European software. Now folks in that part of the world are using Linux to develop their own software. Linus felt really proud of the guy who came up to him at Comdex and wanted to show him the gasoline pump that was running Linux. It was a prototype gasoline pump that was running Linux because he wanted to have web browsers so gasoline customers could go to CNN.com during the 3 minutes they're waiting for their tanks to fill. Standing on the shoulders of giants. To Linus, it's inspiring that people are using technologies like Linux to just make a better gas pump. That sort of innovation is not likely to have happened within the confines of a company, because if you were a company taking Linux to market, you would go for the obvious, which right now is the server market or the high-end desktop market. But open source in general allows companies to make their own decisions about what they want to do. So it's Linux in embedded devices, it's TiVo running Linux, and the Transmeta web slate running Linux, and telephony using Linux. This is how billions of dollars in wealth is being created from open source. It's like letting the universe take care of itself. By not controlling the technology, you are not limiting its uses. You make it available and people make local decisions to use it as a launching pad for their own products and services. And while most of those decisions don't make sense in the larger scale of things, they actually work really well. This is not about trying to spread Linux. It's about making Linux available and then letting it spread itself. And this doesn't apply only to Linux. It applies to any project that's open. Open source makes sense. People don't quibble with the need for free speech. It is a liberty that people have defended with their lives. Freedom is always something you have to defend with your life. But it's also not an easy choice to make initially. And the same is true of openness. You just have to make the decision to be open. It's a difficult stance to take at first, but it actually creates more stability in the end. Think of politics. If the logic that's used against open source were applied to government, then we would always have one-party rule. Obviously, a single-party rule is a great deal simpler than our system of multiple parties, the open political system in which much of the world operates. With one party, you don't have to worry about getting agreement with other people. The reasoning would follow that government is too important to waste on the give and take of openness. For some reason, people see the fallacy of this argument as it applies to politics and government, but not as it applies to business. Ironically, in business, it makes people nervous. The arguments a company uses to keep from opening up technology are convincing. That's not how things are done, management says. And it's scary. People are frightened of change, partly because they don't know how it is going to turn out. By sticking to the status quo, a company can make a better judgment of where it will go, and sometimes that seems more important than being hugely successful. These are companies that will be predictably successful instead of being unpredictably really, really, really successful. It's not easy for a corporation to turn an existing product into an open source product. There are a host of thorny issues. For one thing, over the course of months or years that it developed the product, the company built up a great deal of internal knowledge. This in-house intellectual property is the company's bread and butter. The organization is unwilling to relinquish the intellectual property that keeps it alive. But also, the very existence of this internal knowledge creates a barrier for outsiders. It discourages them from participating. Some companies have made the move from closed to open. One story is Wapit, a Finnish company creating service and support infrastructure for various interactive devices. This project involved the company's wall phone-style web server. For them, the decision to open source their software makes perfect sense. They want to build up their service, but they have to build up their infrastructure first. That requires writing a lot of software. It's a necessary evil, so instead of viewing it as a decision to make its intellectual property available to others, they look at it this way. The writing of software takes a lot of engineering time, but it isn't something that creates value from being tightly held at the company. There were a few things working in Wapit's favor. First, it was not a huge project. Second, the decision to open source was made in the early stages of the company's existence. Management reasoned that it had the resources in-house to develop the product, but it wanted to push to have something more than could be created in-house. It also determined that open sourcing is a good way of furthering WAP as a standard for others to work on. Early in the game, the company asked for Linus's advice, and he told them they needed to fight the urge to have decisions made internally. He suggested that if they were having meetings in which decisions were made, those meetings should not be closed to outsiders. By keeping the decision-making process a company affair, they would run the risk of alienating outsiders, who would have trouble getting past the company's old boy network. That's one of the major problems of establishing and maintaining an open source project from a corporate environment. It's easy to give lip service to open source, but it can unintentionally degenerate into a two-tier society, us versus them. A lot of decisions get made the easy way, sitting at the cafeteria table discussing the options and developing a consensus without ever opening up the discussion to the outside. People from the outside who have valid opinions are essentially voted down by the fact that the decision was already made in the company cafeteria. This was one of the problems that plagued Netscape in the months following the company's much-heralded decision in the spring of 1998 to release the source code called Mozilla for its next-generation browser. It took a long time before the project truly lived up to its open-source promise. There was a camp of Netscape insiders who would not accept small patches from outsiders. Everybody inside knew each other, and if they weren't physically sitting around a coffee shop making decisions, there was a virtual coffee shop in which the insiders stayed fairly close. Instead of being seen as embarking on the first great experience in taking an existing commercial project and opening it up, Netscape generated a bit of bad press. When word of its inactivity got out, Netscape could no longer take the high moral ground. That helped them open up to outsiders. Now the project seems to be much more dynamic. When folks first hear about the possibility of opening up an existing commercial project, they tend to ask the same questions. One question has to do with how people inside the company would feel about the possibility of having an outsider produce work that is better than their own, and having that so publicly noticeable. Linus believes they should feel great about it, and great that they are getting paid for not even doing most of the work. In that regard, open source, or open anything for that matter, is unforgiving. It shows who can get the job done, who is better. You can't hide behind managers. Open source is the best way of leveraging outside talent, but you still need to have somebody inside the company who keeps track of the company's needs. That person may not even be the leader of the project. In fact, it could be a benefit to the company if someone on the outside takes it over and is doing it for free. It's fine if someone outside is doing a better job. The trouble is, the outsider might lead the project in a direction that doesn't satisfy the company's requirements. So the company must take care of its own needs. The opening of the project might enable the organization to shrink its local resources, but that doesn't mean it can get rid of them. The project might expand to become far bigger than it would have been at a single company. Outside resources make for a cheaper, more complete, and more balanced system. But there's a flip side. The expanded system no longer takes only the company's needs into account. It actually might consider the needs of customers. Probably the most vexing thing in the whole process is giving up control and just accepting the fact that outsiders may actually know better. The other difficulty is finding a strong technical leader in the company. This has to be somebody who is trusted by everyone on two levels, both a technical and a political level. It has to be someone who is able to acknowledge the fact that the project may have been flawed from the start. Instead of trying to hide from such problems, the leader must be able to convince everybody that the best thing to do is to go back and start over, which means breaking stuff. It's not a message people want to hear. However, coming from someone who commands respect, it's a message people will accept. Given the nature of office politics and how corporations typically work, the technical lead person would have to be someone with a fairly strong personality. He or she should be somebody who likes working by email and who avoids taking sides. And we shouldn't use the word liaison, because that would imply there are two distinct sides here, the inside camp and the outside camp. And that's not the way it should be. The technical lead person gets paid by the company to do open source. He or she knows, and everybody else knows, that this person is not paid to agree with his counterparts in the company, but simply to do the project. There's a danger with having a leader too closely associated with a company. Folks might trust his or her technical ability, but not the non-technical judgment. Is there a diplomat in the house? It's like, find me one honest man. This is why Linus has tried so hard over the years to avoid getting involved with Linux companies. This is becoming increasingly critical now that the money is materializing. With so many dollars floating around, people start questioning your motivations. For Linus, it's helpful that he's been known as being neutral. You have no idea how important it is to him to maintain that neutrality. It drives him nuts. Okay, open source is not for everyone or every project or every corporation. But the more that people start taking stock of the success of Linux, the more they realize this isn't the knee-jerk rantings of idealistic, unwashed high schoolers. Open up anything, and the possibilities will follow. Linus has been talking about open source for as long as journalists have been asking him about it, which is basically the last 5 years. It used to be that he had to explain and explain what's so great about it. It felt like an endless trek. It was like trudging in mud. People get it now. Nearly a year after we started working together, Linus and I paid a Friday night visit to the car racing batting cage place where we had competed with each other months earlier. This time, Linus clobbered me at both activities. He drove faster and made better hits. Later, over Turkish food, I blamed my lousy performance on a particularly frustrating day at work. He looked up and said, "Well, you've got to hang in there for 3 more months." "Why?" I asked. "Isn't that when you vest your first chunk of stock options?" he said. The reason I bring this up is because the night of our previous competition at the car racing batting cage place, Linus confessed that because of his poor memory, he regularly had to ask Tuva to remind him of his phone numbers. Suddenly, he now remembers somebody else's vesting schedule, and he can rattle off where we were when I first mentioned it to him. A year ago, he seemed to delight in the role of an absent-minded professor, fuzzy about the details of anything less significant than superstring theory or the memory capacity of his earliest computers. Now he is incredibly tuned in. Back in January, we sat in my old hot tub, and I joked about the Marin Historical Commission bugging me to donate it to their museum. In August, he casually says, "Hey, when are you going to donate that hot tub?" He doesn't have to consult an electronic device to remember the dates when his friend Yoko will be visiting. He is plugged into the personal details of friends and coworkers in a way he didn't seem to be a year earlier. In fact, he even knows what's going on with my friends and coworkers. And for a fellow whose first words to me on the subject were, "Actually, I don't remember much of my childhood," he suddenly seems to have conjured up the memories. Did I tell you how embarrassed I was when my mother wanted me to ask my grandfather to give me the extra 100 finmarks I needed to buy my first watch? He asked. The clarity thing is just one way Linus seemed to have changed over the course of an important year in his life. There were little things. In November, we took the family road trip to Los Angeles, partly because the Torvaldses were invited to stay at the Brentwood home of the Finnish Consulate General. Before the trip, Linus was glazed-eyed as he scanned the wine counter of a Santa Clara Safeway. "Help me pick out wine as a gift," he said. "I know nothing about wine." 10 months later, he knows which of two similar Cabernets we should choose from the Bodega Bay Lodge minibar to drink while watching an in-room action movie. I catch him swirling his wine before drinking. And then there's the exercise thing. On my first visit to Linus's home, he seemed to have a typical, geek-like, cavalier approach to his body and physical well-being. The "my body's just there to carry around my brilliant mind" philosophy. Linus even seemed to take pride in the fact that he never exercised. Tuva obviously felt differently. Her karate trophies lined a full bookcase, and her aerobics videos rested on the television set. And it seemed to be a point of contention. "Maybe in 5 years some doctor will tell me I'll have to lose weight or something," Linus said at the time. I like to exercise and figured it should be a main component of our outings. I wanted to introduce him to surfing, but it made sense to start out with boogie boarding. We drove over to Half Moon Bay one afternoon in early May, rented wetsuits and boards, and Linus protested heavily at the thought of wading into the chilly waters of the Pacific, even in a wetsuit. But within minutes, something amazing happened. He delighted in riding the waves. "This is great," he enthused, like a 5-year-old at one point, slapping me a high five. Of course, about 15 minutes later, he developed a nasty leg cramp. From being so out of shape, he reasoned, and had to stop. When the cramp hit, he just sat there in the white water, apparently unable to get up, as waves washed over him. My first thought was, "Oh no, if I kill this guy, I'll have millions of nerds on my case." He looked forward to everything we did during the reporting phase of this book. Playing tennis, racing each other at swimming, doing the scary amusements at Great America, driving golf balls. It got to the point at which he became less interested in sitting around talking into my tape recorder than he was in whatever activity I had arranged. The mud baths, hiking up Mount Tamalpais, shooting pool, whatever. "I could do this on a regular basis," he said, sweating heavily after playing tennis with me near my home. That time, he borrowed both a racket and running shoes. Afterward, he kept his new pair of running shoes in the trunk of his car, just in case. Have you ever lain back on a warm summer's night, looking up at the stars, and really wondered why you are here? What is your place in things, and what are you supposed to do with your life? Yeah, well, neither has Linus. Yet he ended up having a theory about life, the universe, and everything, or at least the subset called life. His theory didn't come about while staring up at the stars, immersed in wonder over the immenseness of it all on a clear night. It came about while he was preparing for a speech. When you become well-known for one thing, people just assume you can be trusted to generate brilliant insight into unrelated bodies of knowledge that have been mystifying humankind for millions of years. And they want you to share those insights before a herd of perfect strangers. No, it doesn't make much sense. Linus got into Linux because he was a technology geek, not because he was any good at public appearances, let alone philosophizing without prudent limits. But few things in life make all that much sense, so he's not complaining. But back to the subject at hand. Linus was invited to a local event in Berkeley called Web Rush. Normally, he wouldn't even consider it, but the invitation came through the Finnish consulate here in the United States. And being a patriotic person, or at least feeling slightly guilty about hating snow and having moved abroad, Linus had said, Okay, I'll do it. Now, nobody expected him to talk about the meaning of life, least of all Linus. But this event was about life in the networked society, and he was there as the internet person and representative of Finland. Finland, due to Nokia, the largest, best, and most beautiful company in the world, as any Finn will tell you, is into communications in a big way, and the networked society is where it is at. So there he sat, wondering what he should talk about regarding communications. Oh, I forgot to mention that most of the rest of the panel would be comprised of philosophers talking about technology. This is Berkeley, after all. Two things they take very seriously in Berkeley are Berkeley politics and Berkeley philosophers. So what the heck? If they were going to have philosophers talking about technology, why not have a technologist like Linus talking about philosophy? Nobody should accuse him of not having balls. So there he is, feverishly trying to come up with a subject to speak about the next day. He never gets around to doing speeches until it is way too late, so late the evening before the event is usually when you'll find him worrying about it. And he's struggling there, trying to ponder the Communications Society and what it's all about, and what Nokia and all the other communications companies will eventually evolve into. And the best he can do is to just explain the meaning of life. It's actually not much of a meaning. It's more of a law of life, hereafter to be called Linus's Law. It's equivalent to the second law of thermodynamics in physics. But rather than explaining the devolution of the order of the universe, it is about the evolution of life. Not evolution in the Darwinian sense. That's a different thing. For Webrush, Linus was more interested in how society evolves and how we moved from an industrial society into a communication society. What's next and why? He wanted to make it sound good and to make enough sense to convince an audience for the duration of a panel discussion. Everybody has his or her own agenda, and that day Linus's agenda was to emerge alive from a panel discussion with two notable philosophers. So why do societies evolve? What's the driving factor? Is it really technology that drives society, which seems to be a common view? Was it really the invention of the steam engine that got Europe started as the industrial society and eventually evolved us through Nokia and cell phones into the communications society? That seemed to be the philosopher's take on this all, and they seemed to be interested in how technology changes society. And Linus, as a technologist, knows that technology drives nothing. It is society that changes technology, not the other way around. Technology just sets the boundaries for what we can do and how cheaply we can do it. Technology, like the devices it creates, is, at least so far, inherently stupid. It's only interesting insofar as what you can do with it, and the driving force behind it is really human needs and interests. We don't communicate more these days because we have the means to do so. We communicate more these days because people are blabbermouths, and they want to communicate. And if the means aren't there, they will be created. Thus, Nokia. So, went Linus's argument, in order to understand the evolution of society, you have to understand what really motivates people. Is it money? Is it success? Is it sex? What fundamentally makes people do what they do? The one obvious motivational factor that probably nobody will argue with is simple. Survival. That is what defines life, after all. It survives. It doesn't just blindly follow the second law of thermodynamics, but instead survives despite a universe that seems fairly inimical to the kind of complexity and order that is the very underpinning of life. So survival is motivational factor number one. In order to rank the other motivational factors, Linus had to consider how they would stack up against that very simple will to survive. The question is not, would you kill for money, but would you die for money? The answer there is clearly no. So we can safely strike money off the list of fundamental motivational factors. But there are obviously things that people are willing to die for. There are a lot of heroic stories of people and even animals who are in fact willing to die for some larger cause. So plain survival alone does not explain the motivational factors that drive our society. The other motivations Linus came up with for the talk in Berkeley were simple and not very contested at the panel. So at least somebody agrees with them. Or, in consideration of the Finnish consulate, they were just being polite. There aren't very many things that man is willing to die for, but social relations is definitely one of them. The examples of social motivation being enough to drive people to forget about survival are numerous. From the literary Romeo and Juliet, dead not because they wanted anything as crass as sex, but because they would rather die than lose their social relationship. To the case of the patriotic soldier willing to risk his life for his country and his family, his society. So chalk up social relations as motivational factor number two. The third and final motivational factor is entertainment. That may sound trite, but it's unquestionably a very strong force. People die every day doing things that they're only doing for fun, jumping out of perfectly operational airplanes just to get the rush, for example. The entertainment doesn't have to be trite. It can be a game of chess, or the intellectual entertainment of trying to figure out how the world really works. It can be the curiosity and exploration of a new world. Anything that makes a person sit in a crowded rocket on top of a gazillion pounds of highly explosive material just to be able to see the Earth from space can certainly be called motivational. And that's it. Survival, your place in the social order, and entertainment, the three things that make us do the things we do. Everything else is what a sociologist would probably call emergent behavior. Patterns of behavior that emerge from those much simpler rules. But it's much more than just, these are the things that motivate people. If that were all, it wouldn't be much of a theory of life. What makes it interesting is that the three motivational factors have an intrinsic order, an order that shows up wherever there is life. It's not just that we're motivated by those three things, they also hold true for forms of life other than human life. And they show up as the natural progression for any lifelike behavior. Survive, socialize, have fun. That's the progression. And that's also why we chose Just for Fun as the title of this tape. Because everything we ever do seems to eventually end up being for our own entertainment. At least if we have been given the possibility to progress far enough. Look at how we classify animals as lower or higher order animals. They all survive, but the higher you get in the evolutionary scale, the more you are likely to first create social patterns. Even ants, fairly low down on the scale, have very strict social patterns that eventually progress into having fun. Playing with your food is not something ants tend to do a lot, but cats do. Ants probably don't enjoy sex either. Yes, take something as basic and delightful as sex. Linus doesn't claim that it is one of the fundamental motivational factors per se, but it's a great example of rather fundamental human behavior that has undergone the whole evolution of life. There's no question that it started out as a pure survival trait. After all, even plants have sex in the survival sense. And at some stage, billions of years ago, sex was probably purely a survival thing for those single-celled animals that would slowly evolve into geeks and other humans. And there's no question that sex, long ago, evolved from a purely survival phenomenon into a very social phenomenon. It's not only among humans that you find marriage ceremonies and a lot of social infrastructure for getting laid. Think of the ritual dance of the sandhill crane, which mates for life, by the way. In fact, inordinate amounts of energy get spent every day on the social courtship rituals associated with the simple matter of reproduction of all the species. Entertainment? That too, of course. Not just among humans, but it is probably no coincidence that the most evolved species on the planet also seems to make the most out of the entertainment aspect of sex. The progression of survival to social behavior to entertainment is everywhere. Take war. Very much a survival trait, back when the only way to get to the watering hole was to kill the people in your way who wanted that source of water for themselves. War has long since become a tool for maintaining social order in society. And with the advent of CNN, it has become entertainment. Like it or not, this seems to be the inevitable progression. Civilization itself follows the same larger pattern. Originally, it was a way to ensure survival by cooperation and power in numbers. That is nothing unique to humans. Most animals, and even plant life, create societies in order to survive better by helping each other. And what is so interesting is how society itself moves from being survival-based toward being more social. How all human civilizations end up building bigger and better roads and communication channels in order to be able to better socialize. And in the end, civilization too becomes geared toward entertainment. Look at the Roman Empire, famous not only for its road building and strong social order, but also, especially later, even more famous for its entertainment. Or look at the United States today. Does anybody doubt that the film and computer game industries are not about ushering in the entertainment society? From having been niche markets not that long ago, they are now among the biggest industries in the richest country in the world. And what is interesting is how this pattern repeats itself in the technology we create. We call the early age of modern technology the Industrial Age, but what it really should be called is the Age of Technological Survival. Technology, up until not that long ago, was almost exclusively for surviving better, being able to weave cloth better, and to move goods around faster. That was some of the original impetus for it all. We call the current period the Information Age. It's a big shift. It's about technology being used for communication and spreading information, a very social behavior, rather than just surviving in better style. The Internet, and the fact that so much of our technology is starting to move toward it, is a big road sign of our times. It means that people in the industrialized countries are starting to take the survival thing for granted, and suddenly the next phase of technology becomes the big and exciting one. The social aspect of communication technology, of using technology not just to live better, but as an integral part of social life. The ultimate goal, of course, is still looming. Past the information society, the entertainment society. A place where the internet and wireless communications, 24 hours a day, is taken for granted and doesn't get any headlines anymore. A time when Cisco is the old market and Disney Corporation owns the world. A time probably not too far in the future. So what does this all mean? Probably not much, Linus says. After all, his theory of the meaning of life doesn't actually guide you in what you should be doing. At most, it says, yes, you can fight it, but in the end, the ultimate goal of life is to have fun. It does, to some degree, explain why people are willing and eager to work on projects like Linux on the internet. For Linus, and for many other people, Linux has been a way to scratch two motivational itches at the same time. Taking survival for granted, Linux has instead brought people both the entertainment of an intellectual challenge and the social motivations associated with being part of creating it all. Linux people may not have seen each other face-to-face very much, but email was much more than just a dry exchange of information. Bonds of friendship and other social ties can form over email. This probably also means that if and when we ever meet another intelligent life form in this universe, their first words are not likely to be, "Take me to your leader." They're more likely to say, "Party on, dude." Of course, Linus always adds, "I might be wrong,